The protests in South Florida have raised questions of police relations with the communities they're supposed to protect. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A Fort Lauderdale police officer was caught on camera pushing a protester to the ground. She was kneeling. The officer was put on administrative leave and is under investigation.
Let me tell you something. The people run the house.
We're talking with Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones. Also, Miami-Dade College has a plan for the fall term. Some students will return to campus, but none of them will be tested. We'll hear from Interim President Rolando Montoya. We'll also look into the class action lawsuit against the organizers of the Ultra Music Festival. There's a battle over refunds. And finally, when will South Floridians get to watch their favorite sports team again? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. A Fort Lauderdale police officer has been suspended, and there will be an investigation into his actions during the protest in Fort Lauderdale over the weekend. Officer Stephen Poherence was captured on video pushing a kneeling woman to the ground during the demonstrations on Sunday. The protest over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of white officers continued on Monday in Miami and Boca Raton. A curfew remains in effect for Miami-Dade, Broward, and West Palm Beach. Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones was at the protest in Fort Lauderdale on Saturday, and he joins us now via Skype. Representative Jones, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me, Lewis.
How would you describe your experience at the protest in Fort Lauderdale? That was, and again, you were there on Saturday, right?
I was there on Saturday, yes.
Yeah. Tell me about what was going on that day.
And just for clarity, it was on Sunday. Sorry about that, Lewis. My experience when the protest started, it was amazing. We all came together, black, white, all of us together, and we gathered. And then we marched. There was a program, and then we marched. We marched to the Fort Lauderdale Police Station, and then we marched back. When we got back to our the Hazinga Park, that is when one of the officers started creating ruckus within the area, and that was Officer Poherence, and he pushed the young lady aside. And when he pushed the young lady aside, that's when everything broke out. That's when the attendees started throwing things at the police officers. The very thing and the reason why we were out there happened at the rally.
And were you close to that? Were you anywhere near where that happened?
I was walking to my car because I had parked in the garage in the area and where it happened. I was literally steps away from where it had occurred. Yes.
Did you get the chance to speak with that woman?
I did not get a chance to speak to the woman. I went on to my car because things had started getting out of hand.
And when you say out of hand, I mean, at that point, what did you see? What was happening?
Members of organizers started throwing things at the officer because that's when things had actually broke out. I know some people are saying that the officer added to it, but no one at any time during that time had agitated the situation. It really was a peaceful protest from 3 o'clock. And after speaking with the mayor, after speaking with the chief, my words to them were, we would be done by 5:30. I kid you not, it was 5:33 and we were done. We were wrapping up, people were walking to their cars.
And there were reports, as you know, from the mayor and other leaders that there were outside agitators at these protests. What do you say to that?
We're not. I'm not going to make an excuse for what Officer Poherence did, because at the protest that I was at, the one that I helped organize, the individuals who came, over 3,000 people, we set the ground rules in the beginning of the of our rally of what the rules of engagement was, why we were here, and we even set the energy that our goal is not to come here to destroy our community. Our goal is to come here to speak about the years of injustices from police brutality, and also to speak about the injustices of Black Americans over the years.
Who are these people then? The people we hear about who get caught in these actions within these clashes with police. And then, of course, those who go on and we've seen, you know, loot storefronts. Who are these people?
Well, let's be clear. Everyone who come there, Lewis, some of them come with a different mindset. Everyone who come they're not coming in the same spirit as many have come. And so when you come into a situation where individuals who are already upset with how we have been treated over the years, and on tacked on with police officers who are like Officer Proherence, who agitates the situation. You create a scenario like you have on Sunday. So were they outside individuals? It could have been, but was it individuals who were also already there who was upset with how the communities have been treated by police officers and by agencies? Absolutely. They probably were there also.
You helped organize this protest. I wondered, what's the process? How did you do it?
Well, we reached out to the city of Lauderhill at first because it was supposed to be in Lauderhill at first. But Lauderhill, they pulled back because they did not want they didn't have the capacity to take on how many people would come because they didn't have the police capacity. And when they pulled back, the organizers from Black Lives Matter Brow Alliance, they wanted to expand and say, well, you know what? Maybe we can go somewhere else. I don't believe in just going into someone's community and not notifying the leadership. So I reached out to Commissioner Sorensen, and I spoke with the chief to let them know that we were coming. And the chief was very gracious. He made it clear that, listen, I do not want to silence anyone's First Amendment right. As long as it stays safe, we're good to go. And I appreciated that because these young people wanted to have the opportunity not only to express themselves, but they wanted to show that we're unified. This is a unified effort that we have going on right now.
But how frustrating then is it that you try to organize these peaceful protests and yet again, you do have that element that shows up and they don't want to be peaceful?
Well, I think we should look at it like this, Lewis. People here in South Florida and across the country are frustrated, angry, exhausted from being told by institutions, by extremists, and even by the occupant of the White House that our lives do not matter, that they are not valued. And for years, we have demanded justice for Black Americans and the need to end the onslaught of daily racism impacting people of color in the United States. And this is about humanity because when injustice against one is injustice against all. And so we are at a tipping point. And this moment in our country will be in the history books. And as the listeners who are listening today, and as we have this conversation, I mean, I encourage the listeners to ask the question, which side of history will you be on?
The officer that I mentioned, the Fort Lauderdale officer caught on camera, again, pushing a woman who was already kneeling, been suspended, is under investigation. Do you believe that's an adequate punishment?
Absolutely. Not only do I believe it's an adequate punishment, I believe that we need to look at what direction we go in when these issues are happening with police and how they treat community members. I think if you begin to look at police and ask them, because I know I've been asking around, and how do we begin to solve this problem? A police officer who goes to my church who said something that I had never thought of, said that we need to start looking at when these settlements happen from these police brutality cases where police officers can't walk away with pensions and you've killed someone or you've harmed someone. And I've never thought of that. But we have to look at how we're doing this. We have to look at our hiring processes within our police forces. We need to look at some ways, not just congressionally, but even across the state. And we have work to do.
I'm talking with Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones. He's part of the protest surrounding the death of George Floyd over the weekend protests throughout South Florida. He was in Fort Lauderdale. You can find more of our coverage of these protests. Go to WLRN.org. Representative Jones, the issue of police brutality against communities of color, something that you followed throughout your time as a lawmaker and as an educator. And I'm wondering, what are the conversations that you have with young men of color about their interactions with police?
Well, first, I think we have to look at this from the perspective of the years of what the Black community have been dealing with when it comes to the injustices of this country, period. And the conversations that I can bring it home, the conversation that I'm having with my nephew who is 20 years old, he asked the question that when is it the right way for us to speak out against these things? And they're asking the question, why? Yeah, why are we still here? Why 401 years later are we still fighting this same fight? And individuals saying when we go out and protest, well, that's not the right way to do it. I echo Trevor Noah and others who have put it so well. Because when Colin Kaepernick knelt against police brutality, people said it wasn't the right way to protest. When MLK marched in Selma, they said this is not the right way to protest. When people marched in the streets of South Africa during apartheid, they said this is not the right way to protest. And so the question now becomes with these young people is, when does this change? When is it the right way? And who's going to stand up for us?
The Broward County Sheriff's Department has had its share of use of force concerns over the years. And of course, we had the most recent case last November, I believe, a deputy caught on camera slamming a high school student's head into the pavement. Again, it was a young African-American male. We're going to be speaking with Sheriff Gregory Tony about this issue tomorrow. What message do you have for him?
Well, my message to Sheriff Tony and to all sheriffs and chiefs is that it's time that we create a true conversation between law enforcement and the community. And until that happens, and until the community can gain trust into the individuals who are supposed to be serving us, there will continuously be a disconnect from the community and the police department. Someone is going to have to step up and say, you know what? The right thing for us to do is to show the community that our goal is truly to protect you. Our goal is not to be the enemy.
Now, Representative Jones, I've heard over the years, as a journalist, I've heard over the years these efforts by law enforcement agencies to communicate and to connect with all their communities, but especially the communities of color, where these issues are most prevalent. So has that not been going on? Has this conversation not been going on? What is that conversation that you want to have?
Well, the conversation that needs to have is a policy change. And I'm not just saying, and don't get me wrong, Lewis, don't think I'm saying that we just need to come to the table and we walk off and continuously have these one-off conversations. Yeah, it's coming to the table to share this is how we want to come together as a community, and then leaving that table to saying, here's what policy looks like when it comes to police brutality. I'll say this, Vice President Biden made it very clear. He called on Congress to immediately take action to deal with these issues when it comes to law enforcement, like outlawing chokeholds, stop the transfer of weapons of war to police departments, improving oversight and accountability, creating model use of force standard. Yeah, these are tangible things. So coming to the table is not just meeting with the community, but taking tangible things like Vice President Biden put out today to bring communities together and show that we want to actively do something to change this dialogue and to change the dynamics of what we're seeing.
Do communities of color have any trust in the police forces, law enforcement?
Absolutely no. I'm not going to even give you a politically correct answer. The answer is no. Even when I get pulled over by the police department, a police officer, even I, in my position, am still scared because I've seen what your capabilities are. You've shown us time and time again what your capabilities are. Even if I'm innocent, even if I don't have anything in my car, you've shown us. So the answer is no.
Is there anything that can be done on a state level? I mean, going back, the legislature is scheduled to reconvene this summer to deal with the budget, but can state lawmakers deal with this? You're waiting for Congress to move, but what can happen in Tallahassee?
Well, I believe we have to hold accountable the local officials who are beholden to those individuals who won't allow us to change, allow these laws to change, who go to House and Senate leadership in the state legislature to speak out against these things that need to change. And truth be told, Lewis, you're right. From a state level, there's no reason why we can't follow behind those things that was put out by Congress, and outlawing certain things and looking at how we like use of force. And 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I filed legislation for us to relook at how we are how police officers use of force or de-escalation tactics. I filed legislation for that. Why? Because it was important. Did it get a hearing? No, it did not. Will it get a hearing now? I don't know. I'm hoping that George Floyd situation is what happened, the unfortunate situation that happened, opens our eyes like it did with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And when we dealt with school safety, everyone's attention was on how can we change what we're doing to keep our kids safe. And now the new question is, what can we do to ensure the police officers are there to protect and serve, and they are not being feared by the Black community?
What about is it the effort of getting the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to look into training?
Yes, it has to start at the head. It has to start at the head. Those are the individuals who, and also even speaking with our police unions. And let me be very clear, Lewis, all police officers are not bad. And that's, I need to put that on the table. I think it might sound very, very cliche-ish, because I know all teachers are not bad, or all lawyers are not bad, or judges are not bad, but all police officers are not bad. But the ones who are have made a bad rap and a bad name for the rest
and
of.
And what have you heard from law enforcement agencies about that idea that you've got some bad apples? Why don't you deal with it? What have they said to you?
There's never a response. They understand that there are bad apples within agencies, and they make it clear there's bad apples in everything, and they try their best to weed them out when they see them, and that's all we get.
Where do the protests go from here? What happens next?
It's pen to paper time. And I want people. So a lot of people ask, marching does nothing. If that's your mindset, understand that every last one of us have a lane that we have to stand in. We all have a lane to be in. Some people are activists, but some people are elected officials. Some people are like yourself, Lewis. You give the news to spread to give information to people. We all have our lane to be on. No one's allowed to sit on the sidelines right now. Every last one of us, whatever your lane is, have to come on the field, because this right now, this is a contact sport. We all are required to deal with what needs to happen. We all are required to do it.
Do you have plans to organize any other protests?
No, my plan right now is to get a group of legislators together and us to sit down and over Zoom and figure out how does this look on paper. We've marched. The protests have happened. Now it's time to put pen to paper. And legislators and municipal mayors and county commissioners and every last one of us are going to have to stand up and not be scared, to make it extremely clear that enough is enough. And we must continue to call out those who are silent, because I see a lot of my friends who are in office who consider themselves allies to the Black community who are silent on this issue. And we have to call them out, and if they're not willing to speak on issues like this, especially our elected officials.
He is Democratic State Representative Chevron Jones. Mr. Jones, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate the time.
I appreciate you, Lewis.
Well, still to come, Miami-Dade College is going to resume classes on campus, but it could be a glimpse into the future of higher education during COVID. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, some students are back on campus this week after Miami-Dade College reopened for the summer, and they've reopened under phase one of their plan. 95% of courses will continue to operate online. A small number of classes that require in-person lessons are back, with strict protocols to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Miami-Dade College is one of the largest community colleges in the country, serving over 160,000 students. The majority are considered low income by the Department of Education. Dr. Rolando Montoya is the interim president of MDC, and he spoke with us last week about the reopening and how the pandemic has impacted the school's finances. You're currently in phase one of Miami-Dade College's reopening plan. What will school look like for the majority of students that are taking summer courses?
To begin, we only have skeleton personnel at the college. That is basically some administrators, and of course, the public safety personnel, the custodial personnel to maintain the facilities clean, especially the restrooms on areas of high activity or flow of people. And then only courses that lend themselves exclusively for face-to-face education, courses that really don't work very well when you do it online. To give you a few examples, at our Homestead campus, we have the pilot training classes. The students have to accumulate flying hours, and the only way to do it is flying an airplane with a pilot instructor next to them. Then we also have the funeral services program at North Campus, and students need to practice embalming dead bodies and making up the dead bodies, preparing for funerals.
Is there any conversation about testing and having a testing apparatus on campus, or is that something that students and staff will have to do on their own?
No, not at this time, for a variety of reasons, but the main ones is that we have serious concerns about the reliability of the tests that are in the market. And we prefer to basically depend on temperature and also depend on some questions that will be asked to the people who arrive to the campus to determine if they have symptoms or not.
What happens if a student or faculty or a staff, anybody, comes back and had tested positive for the virus? What are the steps you have to take then?
At that time, the person will not come back. That's why it is very important that if the person is asymptomatic and might be positive, that's why the mask needs to be used, and that's why the social distance needs to be maintained, and that's why we need to be doing frequent cleaning and disinfestation.
What about contact tracing, though? Let's say you find out a student or staff member just tested positive.
No, we haven't established a protocol for contact tracing at this time. When we go to phase three, and if we would get instructions from the public authorities that the college has to open, it's very possible that part of the protocol at that time, and that would be several months from now, it would be very appropriate to have in our protocol the issue of testing and the issue of contact tracing. You cannot eliminate risk, but you can very much limit the probability of a spread inside the college if the individuals at the college do not have symptoms, do not have fever, they are wearing a mask, and they are maintaining a distance all the time from each other of at least 6 feet. Now, if the person is positive and the person is out and about in the community, that's another issue. But I really need to take care of the situation at the college. I cannot really control the whole geography of Miami-Dade County.
And then one other thing with that is, what has to happen for you to back off of phase one and jump back to what we're at right now, which is basically, again, shutting everything down and remote learning?
In order for that to happen, then we will have to listen to what the state and local authorities are providing as guidance. Up to now, the guidance that we are getting is that it is okay to begin with the process of opening little by little in phases, given the statistics that they are observing. I guess that the authorities or even the college, if we observe a change in the trends, we need to be ready to make any decision, including the possibility of going back to what I would call phase zero.
Is there any concern about liability if somebody were to catch the virus while they're on campus?
It is a concern, and it's something that is discussed, but we have heard from many experts that the burden of the proof corresponds to whoever is accusing the college of being an instrument for infection. And that would be very difficult to demonstrate because you actually can get this virus in any place, in a supermarket or visiting a relative or a friend, filling your tank of gasoline. You never know. Then the question is, how can you demonstrate that the infection took place at the college?
I'm speaking with Miami-Dade College Interim President Dr. Rolando Montoya. Miami-Dade College began phase one of its reopening this week. If you're a student at Miami-Dade College, we want to hear from you. Will you be heading back to campus or doing things remote? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. The majority of the students at Miami-Dade College are considered low income. Nearly half are under the federal poverty level. Many of the students work in the service economy, and that's been hit really hard. How is the college ensuring that these students can continue their education right now?
We are doing it in two ways. The first measure is that the college receives a significant amount of funds from the U.S. Department of Education. Basically, is the support through the CARES Act approved by the federal government. And students are filling applications, and we are also checking in our records that they are eligible for the federal support. The money that we receive from the federal government has to be used for cash stipends paid directly to the students. The money cannot be used for tuition and fees. The money cannot be used to cover debts that the students might have with the college. The money has to be distributed in cash to the students. And then based on the level of need, the level of income of the students, we are giving direct support in cash so that they help themselves covering the extraordinary expenses that they are incurring because of this pandemic. In terms of tuition and fees, we have identified resources in our scholarship account at the college, and more importantly, in Miami-Dade College Foundation, and we are engaging in a very generous plan of scholarships to pay for the tuition and fees for those who are not covered otherwise. We are dedicating about $20 million right now in financial support for coverage of tuition and fees.
I wanted to jump in and ask about, because I'm hearing all of this, and again, a part of it is what you're depending on from the federal government, but I wanted to know where the institution is right now financially. And if this continues for 6 to 12 months, you know, what do you see happening if you're not getting that constant stream of assistance from the federal government?
Well, we want to be optimistic, and we want to believe that the health conditions of the nation and the economic conditions of the nation are going to recover relatively soon. We are thinking more in terms of 2-3 months and not in terms of 6-12 months. But again, there is lots of uncertainty. I can tell you that right now, in what I would call the short term, and the short term would include the summer term and the fall term, we are well prepared financially based on our own reserves and based on the grants from the federal government and the support from philanthropists.
Okay, no, I mean, I understand the optimism, but you said just you're thinking about the next few months. And something that I keep seeing is, you know, that at least the universities are concerned that going into the fall, they're going to see a big dip in applications and admissions. They're going to see a very big dip in their funding. Do you have that concern as well?
Not as much as the universities for a variety of reasons. Number one, our prices, our tuition and fees are very low. The students that universities may be losing are actually selecting community colleges as an alternative because of price, because they are local, and then they don't have to pay for dormitories or meal plans because they remain at home. That is helping us to remain healthy in terms of enrollment. Actually, this summer right now, we are about 3% down versus last year, which is a very healthy situation. And we expect the fall also to be similar.
So the last time that we spoke with you, the plan was to hire the new president of Miami-Dade College. That was supposed to happen in the fall or winter. How has the pandemic impacted the timeline? Will you be leading the system for the upcoming school year?
Not the whole year. The board decided to postpone the process. And during the board meeting of June, they are going to be proposing a new timeline and a new process with the idea of maybe selecting something in the fall, somebody in the fall, September, October, for immediate beginning if possible, or if not, for beginning on January. And I have heard comments, although I haven't read the resumes, I have heard comments that not necessarily you have many applicants that are at the level that it requires to preside Miami-Dade College.
I wanted to just wrap up with these last couple of questions. We think about how the world is changing because of this pandemic, and there may be certain types of jobs that disappear. And I'm wondering, you know, your thoughts as an educator, what fields of study are going to be harmed by this pandemic and which ones will grow?
It's hard to tell, but I can tell you that, for example, everything that is related to technology, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, digital marketing, and those kinds of fields, animation, cinematography, and so on, that lend themselves to this type of electronic and remote operation of our lives and the economy, probably will be very successful. I still believe that liberal arts has a role, and even when you train people in all these programs, there must be a component of liberal arts. Social sciences in the humanities and so on may suffer, but still those courses will remain as part of the overall curriculum to make individuals better citizens and better decision makers. Right now, everything that has to do with hospitality management, hotels, restaurants, cruise lines, tourism, etc., is very much affected in the market. But you know what? Our students remain enrolled. Those who were already in those programs remain enrolled. Time will tell what kind of evolution, what type of recovery we will see in those industries. But I perceive this to be more a short-term situation than a long-term situation.
Broward College announced that they're going to move towards ending all sports, and they'll have a decision later this month. But are there any plans for Miami-Dade College to suspend sports or other activities?
No. Actually, we have the necessary financial resources to maintain the personnel, to maintain the facilities, and to maintain the scholarships and support that we provide to the athletes at the different teams of the college. Then our decision is to protect them and to maintain them.
Dr. Montoya, as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, and stay safe.
Thank you. The same for you.
That was Dr. Rolando Montoya, interim president at Miami-Dade College. And if you're a student at MDC, we'd love to hear from you about your experience so far this summer or your plans for the fall. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. Well, still to come, Ultra was one of the first major events to be moved because of the coronavirus. Now fans want their money back, and they're suing to get it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, thousands of electronic music lovers from around the globe were scheduled to visit Miami for the Ultra Music Festival in Bayfront Park. That was supposed to be in March. Miami Mayor Francis Suarez postponed Ultra because of the pandemic, and now fans are out of hundreds of dollars for their tickets. In some cases, VIP tickets were worth thousands. Ultra has refused to refund the tickets, claiming the event is postponed. Now, a class action lawsuit has been filed to get that money back. The Miami Herald's Joey Fletch just joins us now. Joey, let's go back to the day the city of Miami decided to postpone the festival. What were the conversations between the city and the organizers?
This was during the very earliest days of fears of the spread of the coronavirus really started to be discussed here in South Florida. And in particular, because of the upcoming calendar, right? We had Ultra. We also had the Kanye Ultra Music Festival. We had the Youth Fair. We had big spring events. And so the conversation became, at what point do we, if we decide we're going to call it off, do we call it off? The conversation that was made public, because I know I would have loved to have been a fly on that wall, was they had to make a decision before the setup for the festival began in earnest. It's a lot of, you know, stages, a lot of equipment. They take over Bayfront Park. So it was right before that really got in, into the weeds is when they decided they were going to pull the plug.
And is it mostly the city? Did the organizers have a say in this?
It was the city who invoked their right to be able to be able to cancel it with a short notice under an emergency. The reason I use cancel, by the way, is because I think it's functionally canceled. It's not happening this year, but they invoked it in a legal sense as a postponement. And that's a pretty interesting distinction to make. Yeah. Considering now this lawsuit.
Well, you think about this. I mean, a lot of concerts and shows obviously were stopped because of the pandemic. And the big story nationally was with Ticketmaster. Concerts that were postponed, there were no refunds. If it was canceled, you can get a refund, right? That's the difference. It's just the difference in the idea.
That's right. It's the difference in the idea. And there's a legality to it that, as you noted, right, is going to be hashed out in this court case and probably others as around the country.
So the postponement means what? That people who are going to go to Ultra, they have a credit for next year or the year after if it comes back?
If it comes back, right. There's still a contractual ability for the city to say we are not going to allow the festival to return next year, is my understanding. I think there's actually a lack of clarity even in some of the resolution language that the city has put forward, because the resolution that's on the June 11th agenda, which is for the city commission, is going to be looking at this on the 11th. It's a resolution to for the city not to exercise its ability to cancel next year's event, and then to not oppose the following year's event as a sort of to make up for the March 2020 event not happening.
We're talking with the Miami Herald's Joey Fletches. A class action lawsuit has been filed by ticket holders for this year's Ultra Music Festival. They want their money back because the event was postponed, not canceled. You could read his story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Joey, what's the chance that Ultra ever comes back to Bayfront?
That's a great question. It's become an even more interesting question in the past 2 years. You know, the walk up to the situation we're in included, you know, 2 years ago, a summer debate that ended in the fall with Ultra not coming back. And they moved to Virginia Key last year. That was a logistical nightmare for all parties concerned, so much so that Ultra even pulled out themselves voluntarily from that agreement from coming back to Virginia Key. And then they landed back in Bayfront Park. So they're already, it's already a touch and go every year, it seems, at this point. Now, with COVID-19, with political considerations, because there always are, with neighbors suing the city, neighbors, downtown residents saying that Ultra poses a health risk, before COVID-19, to their hearing and to their well-being and the comfort and enjoyment of their homes. Now, with the virus, it becomes an even bigger ball of wax. And so I don't know if there's a good chance. I don't know if you can put a percentage on it, but it's always up in the air.
You said there's a meeting coming up June 11th. The future of the event, is that what's going to be discussed?
Yes, they're going to talk about there's a resolution on their plate. They're going to consider whether or not they're going to decline to exercise a right to cancel next year's event in 2021. And then also say that they're not going to oppose Ultra returning in 2022. It sort of functions as a 2-year endorsement for Ultra.
And what do the organizers of Ultra say? What do they want?
They've been very quiet. The organizers of Ultra have, I know they haven't really responded to requests from the Herald since that week, really, when the discussion was to pull the plug on this year's concert. So, and when I asked them about the class action lawsuit last week, I got no response. So they've been only communicating in whatever you see in the public, really, or directly to ticket holders, which obviously has been pretty upsetting for many of them.
I wonder, Joey, what you've been hearing, whether from city leaders or just, you know, businesses, anybody around the community, I mean, about the future of big events like Ultra. And, you know, what's the concern that we may never see that kind of stuff, at least not for a long time?
I mean, if we do, the conversation tends to go to, is it going to be the same? Which I think the answer at this point for in a lot of people's minds is no. It's even if you see a quote large event, how will it play out? How will it be managed? What will ticketing and attendance look like? But at least as far as something like in the neighborhood of Ultra or Calle Ocho, which was canceled shortly thereafter in the city, I'm not sure that people are even ready to talk about it in elected officials. I mean, this is on the June 11th agenda. But in a story I wrote last week, you know, the mayor said that he wasn't even sure that this is a conversation that is appropriate right now. So it might even be premature in some leaders' minds. I think we can expect there to be, no matter what, a very different look for large events in Miami.
You know, and we think about, for example, the debate about like bringing sports back, and they thought if we could have fans, you'd have to social distance them, do temperature checks. To even have anything, I mean, and again, only half capacity. Can you have an Ultra if you're social? I have to laugh a little bit because I can't picture it. But can you have an Ultra or any kind of festival like that, Calle Ocho, with social distancing?
I don't think you can. Right now, could there be a management plan for such a thing? I think it's a tall order. Ultra is the, by design. An event where people come together very close, they dance, they're sharing, you know, a lot of very intimate, close space. It's hot, it can rain, you know, I've done all of these and covering for the Herald, and it's unenforceable in my mind. There's no such thing as social distance when you're crowding in front of the stage because your favorite performer is playing.
Yeah.
So I don't see it.
I can possibly see them turning masks into neon glittering masks that they could sell and make a lot of money on that. What about some of the other festivals? Three Points, that's still on the books?
So the last update I received from that festival, this was in late March. They had actually secured dates in October 16, 17. They had already moved the festival from earlier in the year to May. They were sort of on standby too, just in case they had to move dates again or sort of, you know, postpone it further. It's I think too early to tell. It's worth updating. Probably I should check and see what the current permitting issue is with Three Points, because the city can tell them, like, even this far ahead of time, I think, like, we don't see it. I'm not aware if there's anything upcoming up on Three Points.
Oh, when will we get to see a good show? I've said it before, man. I missed on going to Pearl Jam because of all this, but all right. Anyway, we'll leave it at that. Miami Herald's Joey Fletches. Again, read more about the fate of the Ultra Music Festival. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, a lawsuit is going on. Joey, thanks so much.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
So for music festivals to live sports, events are going to be dramatically different because of this pandemic. Major League Baseball, National Basketball Association, National Hockey League, they're all in discussions about how to restart their seasons. The NHL, they decided we're going to end the regular season, go straight to the postseason. The Florida Panthers would be part of that. The Miami Heat have already talked about getting practices started. There's a proposal for all the teams to play at the Walt Disney Sports Complex in Orlando. No fans will be allowed in these arenas and stadiums to take part. That's part of the new requirement. Joe Rose is the former Miami Dolphins tight end. He hosts the sports talk radio show, The Joe Rose Show, with Zach Krantz on WQAM here in Miami.
This has been a new experience, I think, for all of us all over the country, and talking to all the other sports radio guys that we've done stuff together and with each other. It's been a unique experience, but after the first couple shows, I just realized, because so many people are listening and following, not only locally, but nationally, So it you realize that there's still a lot of people out there to make sure you bring your A game every day. But as far as being in the house and going from the bed to the bathroom to your office, it's a little different. Yeah, it's been a little different experience instead of that beautiful intercom studio.
You know, I think about the things I miss, and I'm wondering, how long do you think that we can go without sports?
Man, not much longer. It has been very interesting, because I know I feel it as a sports junkie my whole life, and I can feel it from other people. Like, man, we got to get back some live sports. We're not even worried about fans in seats right now at games. We just want to see live sports. And I think it's really important to the psyche for everybody out there. So hopefully, you know, safely, in a safe way, of course, we're going to be able to get our baseball started, finish our hockey and our NBA season. We got a really good NBA team down here in the Miami Heat. But I can feel it, and I can sense it with everybody that people want to get back to live sports and see their favorite athletes.
Okay, so we did sort of have sports recently with the NFL draft, so that gave yeah. us something to get excited about. And so let's talk about the Miami Dolphins. I mean, you played for them back in the 80s. This team during the draft, there was a lot of excitement because we felt like there's a new coach. He drafted a new quarterback and some big names to surround him. And it seems like there's an excitement again about the Dolphins. Should we be excited about them right now?
I think so. I haven't felt like this in a long time. The Brady Belichick thing has just destroyed the AFC East, and we're part of it. And so, yeah, and then getting Tua in the first round, there's been a real buzz around this team. We had a lot of high draft picks this year. And I think Brian Flores, we feel like we've got the right coach. So people are really excited about Coach Flores taking over. So I think when you put all that stuff together and Brady is now in Tampa Bay and not with Belichick, I think people are really excited. Listen, we've had great history down here for a long, long time with Coach Shula and what he started and what he built. And I know fans really want to get back to some winning football.
You said it a moment ago. You know, there's a need for sports, and we can accept it without fans. But here's the thing. We don't know what's going to happen. And we don't know if there's going to be a football season, and we're keeping our fingers crossed. But, you know, all the sports leagues are trying to figure out how to have games. The NFL did release its schedule for next season. But what have you heard from players, from league owners, from the league itself? You know, is there a real concern that maybe there won't be football this year?
Well, I think the most optimistic group is the NFL right now, because even if they slide a few months, they realize they can get the season in. And so if we can't start regular season in September, we can slide it. But I feel like the NFL is definitely going to get their full 16 games in. I feel really good about it. They've got some good plans. There's been a lot of stuff thrown out, as you know. I'm still a little concerned about right now, and we live in a hot spot down here for the coronavirus. As you know, down in Miami-Dade County, it's still been hit pretty hard. So a little bit for those guys staying safe and still getting back, even though American Airlines Arena has opened their practice facility for the Heat. Tomorrow will be the first day. But even saying that, sure, there's concern, and the players are concerned for their families. If they do get it, everybody seems a little concerned. We see the stories. How bad will my health be? What will it do to my lungs? I've heard a lot of that. But the guys want to play. I mean, they want to get out there. All the guys we've talked to, people from the teams down here, they want to get back. They want to finish their seasons. And in the case of the Marlins, they want to get theirs started.
You know, the other thing too, and you said it, is one of the things they're bringing up is this question of playing sports with no fans. And what in the world would football be like without fans?
Wow. Heck, we have practice games, and we have, as you know, around the NFL, 5, 10, 15, 20,000 fans show up. Even when they're not tackling, they're just having a real aggressive practice before the preseason starts. I can't even imagine what it's going to be like. It's starting to feel more like reality. We're going to start seeing it soon with hockey, basketball, and Major League Baseball and other sports and Major League Soccer as they start to open up for everybody. But there is a possibility that there will be no fans or, you know, partial fans when you start to socially distance people. So I'm almost for a little fake noise in there. You know, if it's home, you get to put some fake noise into there that they can do just to make it feel like you have home field or you're getting booed on the road or something, right?
Well, I know I'm tired of Netflix. I'm looking forward to some sports.
Me too, man. I'm with you, man. I'm about burned out. I can't watch Narcos for a fifth time, man. I'm with you.
Joe Rose, always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And that is Joe Rose, host of The Joe Rose Show with Zach Krantz. And yeah, I'm tired of Netflix. I'm ready for some sports. Oh, we had a great Heat team. The Panthers are even going to the playoffs. And I mean, I even missed the Marlins. Oh, by the way, we have a soccer team, which I was waiting 5 years for. Are you missing sports like I am? Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Love to hear your thoughts. You know, how badly you miss it. How badly we need it. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, June 2nd. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to be speaking with Broward County Sheriff Gregory Tony. What questions do you have about law enforcement conduct during protests? Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We will include your questions as part of our conversation. Plus, how are artists continuing to be creative during this pandemic? WLRN's morning anchor, Christine DiMattei, has spoken with ballerinas performing in their living room to symphonies performing on Facebook Live. And she's going to share with us a little bit about how she is finding what artists are doing to get through this time. Again, always find us at WLRN.org or on social media at WLRN Sundial. We're on again tonight at 8. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow live.